Welcome to The Political Nomad. I'm your host, Josh Gillespie. Thanks for tuning in this week. I'm excited about this next conversation. That's because it's with someone I've known most of my adult life. I first met Jacob Perry in April, I believe it was, of 2004 at a Starbucks in Barnes & Noble. You guys remember bookstores, right? The big chains had the big chain coffee shops in them. Anyway, I had been invited by a congressional candidate to a call-out of sorts. It wasn't all that organized, but there I met a giant of a man. Jacob was striking. He would always easily stand out in a crowd. Obviously, he made an immediate impression. Fast forward over the last 16 years, and Jacob and I have formed a pretty close bond. In fact, he's one of my closest friends. He's one of the few friends who I've wanted to work with, but never have, despite our best efforts over the years. We've been on the opposite sides of congressional primaries, sparred a bit during local blogging wars, but we've always remained friends, in the best of times and in the worst of times. We've each felt the resounding sting of what it's like to be political cast-offs for one reason or another. Jacob is a veteran campaigner. He started off as a Democrat, but he's run Libertarian campaigns, Republican campaigns, and written for countless candidates and clients. He knows winning and losing. He knows politics. And whether he's been right, which with a lifetime of experience he usually is, or wrong, Jacob has had an opinion, a well-informed one, mind you, to share with you. I like to think of the Frank Sinatra song, My Way, when I think of how Jacob has gone about his career. His political journey really is like no other person's story that I've had on this podcast. Please welcome Jacob Perry. Thanks for being on the show this week, Jacob.
Cheers, brother.
Cheers. I know you got your drinks of choice tonight, so let's see how those impact the show.
Stick around.
All right. So, again, you know, thanks for being on the show this week. I feel like, you know, when I asked you, you were reticent, you know. Yeah, I felt like it was almost like pulling teeth to get you on this show. But I'm glad that I got you here. And, again, you know, I've mentioned in the opener there that you have had quite the career. And the best word to describe it, and I've used this on a couple of other people, but I really believe this applies to you, is roller coaster. You've had highs, you've had lows, and some of them have been the highest of the highs and some of them have been the lowest of the lows, but there has been so much that has brought you to this point. So kind of give my listeners, you know, an idea of what formed your initial political leanings, because you literally have been on all over the political map. And although I feel like in the last few years you've kind of grounded yourself in where you firmly stand, and in many ways that's kind of cost you. But usually when people set on principles, that does cost them. Tell us a bit about your story.
So, unlike you, I didn't grow up, you know, having any interest in politics, at least as a career. In fact, I didn't know that was a thing. I didn't know that people actually made a living doing this. Of course, that assumes I've actually made a living doing this, and that's probably debatable. So I grew up, my parents were literally hippies. And some of this I think you know, but this is obviously for the benefit of the audience. My dad, I'm fairly sure, was at Woodstock.
No way.
Yeah, so my dad is from Buffalo, from upstate New York, which is like 30 minutes from Woodstock, and graduated high school in 1969, and was a massive hippie. I mean, before he and my mom got together, he lived in a treehouse in Northern California for like 3 years. I mean, he just, you know.
That's great.
You know, I've seen the treehouse, and it's a legit thing, and it was pretty neat. But it's like basically like a picnic table hanging in a tree. That's what it seemed like to me at the time.
I love it.
And so my parents were both very hippie, you know, very, I don't want to say far left. I think, you know, and hi, Mom and Dad, hope you don't mind me saying this. I don't think they would have seen themselves as hippies or very liberal. Although my dad was very politically active, you know, my dad essentially, you know, spent 3, 4, 5 years in junior college just to maintain a student deferment from the draft. Probably burned his draft card. I don't know if he remembers anymore or not. So he was very much an activist, very involved in that kind of stuff. And when I was a kid, he still had, in fact, I still have, his college history and government books that I used to read that I thought were just really fascinating. And so it wasn't something that we talked about. Like, it wasn't like a conversation around the table. But I always, like, every day, this is for the young kids are going to be confused by this reference, but, you know, I used to read a newspaper every day, which was, you know, this paper thing. You probably remember those, you know, it was this long piece of paper that were, they would have, like, the news from the day before in them, and you would read them, and that's how you would learn things.
Wait a minute, you got news from the day before?
Yeah, it's kind of weird, you know, but it kind of gave you time to process and understand what was going on and think about it. And then I watched the 6:30 evening news every night, the national news, religiously. And I don't really know why. It wasn't something that was encouraged or pushed or my dad was big on. It just was something that interested me. And I remember, I know you've asked other people this, my first political memory was the 1980 election, and I was in kindergarten. And I remember going to school on, I have a very vivid memory of this. I remember going to school on election day, and my teacher, or me asking my teacher, actually, who she voted for that day. And I will never forget, she gave me this weird look, and she said, well, Jimmy Carter, of course. You know, like, God forbid, wouldn't even occur to her to vote for anybody else.
Yeah.
Now, granted, you know, where I grew up, I'm fairly sure I was pretty much the only white English-speaking kid on my block. You know, I grew up basically in the hood. Shout out Lauderhill, Tamarack. Kind of the hood. More so the hood now than it was then. But it's certainly, you know, lower middle class. My parents mowed yards for a living. You know, my paternal grandparents, neither one of them finished elementary school. And so, you know, I have a census. I actually have a copy of a census from, I think it was 1940 or 42 or one of those, where my grandfather at age 14 was listed as a full-time farm worker at age 14. So he was picking cotton in Alabama. So that's kind of where I come from. And that probably shaped my, I guess, my politics, my worldview, just like it would did yours and everybody else. And so I probably would have considered myself a liberal Democrat, although very anti-communist. You know, that was kind of a thing in our house. I don't remember why, if it was that's from my dad or what, but remember being very anti-communist. So probably more of a Jimmy Carter, you know, old school blue dog Democrat, working class Democrat.
Yeah.
You know, not like the Rose Democrats and all the nonsense they got going on now. So that's kind of where I came from.
It's so interesting because a lot of that, I mean, some of that I knew, a lot of that I didn't. And I kind of think of that in terms of, like, Johnny Cash's background. He grew up in the cotton fields of Arkansas.
Yeah.
And again, I would probably consider, and I would probably consider him probably like a blue dog Democrat, that Jimmy Carter Democrat. And in fact, I mean, he was related by marriage to Jimmy Carter through the Carter family.
Correct.
Through the June Carter's family. And so I could see how that could have informed your early leanings. And I think it's funny that you asked your teacher in kindergarten who she voted for. I remember politics playing an important part in my life in elementary school, but I don't even think it impacted me that early. I think it was when I found out that I was related to a president that I was like, oh, hey, all right, well, this is destiny.
By the way, doesn't it suck that if you're going to be related to a president, it's the one you're related to?
Oh, it could be a lot worse, in my
opinion.
That's
true.
I mean, Harding... Yeah, I mean, Teapot Dome, not good.
I feel like we've had this conversation a few times over the years.
We have. We have. There's a good book that I have on my shelf that I cannot go and reach, and I currently forget who it's by. But it's by a respected historian who did a history of Warren Harding, and he actually makes the argument that he wasn't as bad as history has made him out to be. However, he does the historian acknowledges that, when you die in office and you already have a bunch of enemies, your enemies are going to be writing your history.
That wasn't true.
And two, he did make a lot of dumb choices in terms of cabinet positions. But his policies were actually spot on. He also was he wanted to resegregate the government, which Wilson had desegregated the government. And a lot of the fiscal policies that Coolidge gets credit for were ones that were going to be enacted by Harding had he not died. So, you know, Coolidge gets the credit, and rightfully so, but they weren't initially his ideas. So, Harding gets a bad rap, and I'm not saying it's not deserving, but at the same time, it is sort of undeserving. That said, I think it's interesting that you started out there as, you know, kind of a blue dog in your initial leanings. What, as you progressed, as you grew up, what brought out, you know, either the libertarian or the Republican side? Because I think you were probably libertarian before you were more Republican. Just based on how I got to know you and through the campaigns that you work for. And I know that you ran a libertarian candidate against a friend of both of ours, a mutual friend of ours, who we both have the utmost respect for. But that was – you ran that campaign before you ran Republican campaigns. As you mentioned before we even started the podcast, you reminded me of this, that you spent some time working for Democrat Congressman Julia Carson in Indianapolis. So I got to know – Julia was elected in 96. I met you in 2004. You ran that libertarian campaign in 2002. Kind of bring us up to speed of where the things changed there, because a lot seemed to have happened in those short years.
So the first campaign that I ever had any involvement with was the 92 Clinton-Gore race, which I still have a campaign t-shirt from. And
Lecter's item.
I almost said something, but this is a family show, so we're not going to do that. I haven't had a DNA tested, though. I basically, short story is, I was my senior year of high school. That was my senior year, and I was failing government, ironically, and mainly just because I didn't show up for class.
That's a problem.
That'll do it. And so my teacher, whose son is now the government teacher at my high school, who was my classmate, Mr. Wright, who was a bit of a political activist himself. He sort of wanted, and you know the type, the high school government teachers who, you know, go to all the events and they're kind of gadflies and they sort of get involved. And that's how he was. And so he basically came to me and said something to the effect of, I will give you a shit ton of, a bunch of extra credit points. Sorry, Dad. a bunch of extra credit points. I'm sure it's a word he's never heard before. A bunch of extra credit points if you will. I don't remember if he said get involved or do campaigns or something, but I didn't know that was a thing. Like I said before, I legit didn't know. I was so far removed from the political world and infrastructure, and I'd never met an elected official. I'd never gone to an event. I'd never, you know what I'm saying? So I never, that world was totally foreign to me. And so what I literally did was I drove down to Marion County Democratic Party headquarters, downtown Indy, and walked in the front door. And they were like, hey, how's it going, whatever. And I said, I don't know what to do, but I want to volunteer. And I got a shirt and a bumper sticker and a desk with a phone on it. And I started off phone banking. And then somebody needed a ride to the airport. And I was around, and I took him to the airport, and then I graduated being a gopher, and then that just sort of was the progression. I don't know if that even makes any sense. And And then I ended
I
up.
think to those of us who have been in politics, that actually does kind of that makes sense. Like you start at the bottom and you slowly work your way up. I'm kind of curious, and I apologize for interrupting here, but I'm kind of curious, you know, what were, I mean, if you don't have a big interest in politics, what is it that makes you sit down at that phone bank and think, I believe what I'm reading, and I'm trying to get others to believe what I'm reading?
And even more so because you know me, you know how much I hate the phone. So you probably find some irony in that, as do I. I think, you know, I have a very strong background in athletics and played team sports my entire life. Started playing soccer when I was like 4, and literally played, you know, in high school I was a state-ranked swimmer, and I was a triathlete. I played soccer, ran cross country, did a bunch of different things. And I think part of it was the team sport aspect. I kind of have always gone back to this, where politics was the only other thing that remotely, and this became even more true as I got older. You know, I felt very comfortable because I'd spent most of my life in locker rooms. And so I don't know that I even looked at it like, holy crap, I'm going to get Bill Clinton elected. I'll be honest with you, I'm not even sure I cared that much. I think it was acceptance. You know, I suffered from depression when I was in high school, and suddenly, and you know this world very well, suddenly, you know, I earned my way into the inner circle, you know, and I was accorded trust and responsibility and treated with more respect than I was, frankly, at school or anything else that I did. And so I think that probably was the initial pull. And I ended up essentially having the title of volunteer coordinator, basically Perry Township, which is where we lived. As you know, I went to Southport High School. Mm-hmm. And which back in those days, Marion County was about, you probably remember this, was about 97% Republican. I mean, there were like 9 Democrats in Marion County. So to be able, you know, to say that I had some kind of a title in the campaign sounds really, you know, impressive until you remember that I was one of 9 Democrats in Marion County, and probably one of 2 white ones, quite honestly.
It was a shell of an organization.
100%. So that was part of what it was. It was by default, you know, I made my way through the organization and impressed some people. Got to know Julia, got to know Andre, because Andre and I are the same age, same school year. And that's kind of where it started. But I literally never had any intention of making it a thing. It was just something kind of cool to do.
Yeah.
I don't know if I answered your question, but I feel like you asked something.
No. I think that you did. I mean, it was like what I get that aspect of the team sport, because what I was asking was, you know, what is it that made you read that script that you believed it? Like you could just walk in there and believe what you're reading if you didn't have any interest beforehand.
I just wanted to prove myself, quite honestly. I think I was given an opportunity. And I kind of have that personality. And so I was given an opportunity and I wanted to prove myself and I wanted more attention and more feedback and whatever. And so I guess that was my motivation.
Well, it's what you touched on earlier that I think that a lot of people underestimate about politics in general. And that is the need to belong. Yes. And how politics... that is the siren song of politics, is that Republican, Democrat, Libertarian, it really doesn't matter. It's politics as a whole. It needs you to feel like you belong.
Correct.
So that it can use you.
It's actually one of the things that the Libertarians have never figured out, quite honestly.
Well, let's see if Amash fixed that. Anyway, that's a conversation for another day.
Yes, that'll be for episode 4, I think.
Yeah. But no, I think that what you hit on there, it's like it politics gives those who don't feel a sense of belonging, not only that sense of belonging, but it gives you a sense of purpose.
Yes.
Like and like you equated it to a team sport, and it is. You feel like you're part of a team until it swiftly reminds you that no, you're not. You're just a cog.
It's a team that loses all the time, so you know you're basically the Marlins. But I think you can.
Hey, but to the Marlins, to the Marlins' credit, they do have two World Series victories.
that would be for episode 5. We'll discuss that one. And, you know, because you've worked with me, I hope you can attest to this. One of the things that I've always taken a lot of pride in is trying to build and foster this team atmosphere among the staff and among the people. Because, quite honestly, 90% of the people aren't getting paid. Or if it's an Andy Horney campaign, 99% of the people aren't getting paid. Or 100%, quite honestly. Sorry, Andy. And so there has to be something more to it. And so for me, because that's where I'm naturally drawn, I love that team environment. And I, you know, have excellent relationships with a lot of people who work with me, and not just you. And so I take a lot of pride in that. And so I think that's what I felt when I first went in. And so I have tried to duplicate that myself for the last, oh my God, 30 years. Ooh, that just hit me. So, but
yeah, it's been a long time.
True. I mean, that's kind of what I've always looked for.
Yeah. So I guess, when did you start noticing a change? So if you went in as a Democrat, and again, you started getting involved in the machine, but eventually you moved on to Libertarian politics, to Republican politics, but when did you first start noticing that shift, whether it was in political leanings or maybe it was something that you saw? I mean, what caused you to start shifting your politics initially?
There were two things. One is, because I'm a student of history and majored in history in college, I believe very strongly that all leaders require a moral authority to lead. And that goes back to ancient times. And so I think the Clinton issues, just for lack of a better term, sort of made me start questioning things. I think that's where I went from all Democrats are good, all Republicans are evil, to, hey, maybe my guy's just as big of a scumbag as the other guys. And because I'm an autodidact and I read, you know, 1 to 3 books a week, unless there's a worldwide quarantine, then I'm reading like one a day. You know, I picked up, and I don't remember if anybody recommended it to me, if I just was digging through the stacks, but I picked up John Locke, and I read 2 treatises of government. I think probably I was 20 or 21. And I can still remember the physical sensation of being blown away when I understood the concept that if rights are granted by government, then rights can be taken away at whim of said government. And if the government has the right to essentially grant or withdraw your rights whenever it wants to, then you're not free. You don't have liberty. And my dad, I mentioned before, who was a hippie, whatever, but my dad is probably always more libertarian than me. Very pro-freedom, very pro, you know, government, get the hell off my back, you know, leave me alone. I think he was more anti-establishment than he was liberal in his leanings. Mm-hmm. And so that really hit home with me. And it still does. I mean, even talking to you right now, I remember reading that, like, essentially that section, 3 or 4 pages, and just rereading it, because I kept thinking, I must be missing something. You know, it can't be that simple. But it really is that simple. And so once you make that titanic shift from government is the grantor of your rights to somebody else has to be the grantor of your rights, which, of course, you know a door that opens.
Sure.
Then that changed my entire worldview. So I probably was, like I said, 20, 21. You don't know that I was ready to make the plunge. You know what I mean? Like, I didn't go drive down and suddenly change my registration. But it certainly made me look much more closely at, you know, politics and candidates in particular and positions. And I moved back to Indy. I graduated high school, went to IU for a stretch, moved away, had some adventures, and came back. I moved back to Indy, I believe, summer of 97. I might be a year or two off, but it was somewhere in that range. In 98, I got involved. I still worked for, I think I worked for Julia. I think I went back, and I say worked for, I make it sound more impressive than what it actually was. I probably, you know, put out yard signs in one of the townships. Like, I'm not trying to say that I was, you know, her advisor or whatever, but that was 98. And then the real titanic shift for me was the 99 mayor race. That was the life-changing Indianapolis mayor race. And I was a Bart Peterson guy. Bart and Julia were close. And I knew Bart and liked Bart. And Bart was kind of at that time more my kind of a Democrat, you know, more of the moderate, blue collar, you know, even though he was very cerebral and intellectual, he wasn't crazy far left Democrat.
No, for those who, to kind of give an idea of Bart Peterson, Bart Peterson was in the vein of Evan Bayh here in Indiana. For those who remember Senator Bayh,
Senator Evan Bayh, that's kind of where I came from.
Yeah, they're the kind of Democrats who are they're more cerebral. They're not reactionary. They were very well thought out.
I ever met in person when I was in eighth grade government class. We took a tour of the Capitol building in downtown, and he was in his office, and he actually walked in, was in his office and greeted all of us. And as we were leaving, I stole a business card off his desk, which I still have somewhere.
That's nice. That's fine. When he was governor. So that's a historical item right there. So that's interesting that the John Locke shift, and it's interesting that happened in, I mean, the major shift for you was in 99, because my recollection of the 1999 mayor's race, it was Bart Peterson. Indianapolis Republicans had held the mayor's office since the 60s when Richard Lugar was mayor.
It literally was
a machine, and the current Secretary of State at the time, Sue Ann Gilroy, was running for the Republicans.
Right.
And I don't know if she just thought it was a foregone conclusion that she'd win because it was Indianapolis.
She did.
But Peterson kind of, I wouldn't say he came out of nowhere, because he was well-funded, but he put up a better fight than I think most people expected. And not only did he rally the few Indianapolis Democrats that there were, to get that victory, he had some crossover appeal.
He did. And so the story is basically, I was a low to mid-level volunteer for BART. Again, field work. That's kind of my expertise. That's where I got started in the business. And I remember this very clearly, the very first debate, and you left out somebody, which I think is kind of interesting, so I'm going to fill in the blanks for our audience.
I honestly don't think Andy had that big of an effect on the race, but what do okay, I know? But, I'd like your point of view.
He's central to the story, though, because what happened was, I remember thinking that Bart was milquetoast. Like, he really wasn't.
Oh, yeah.
Not granted, Evan Bayh was milquetoast, so in his defense, it worked for Evan.
No, they're one and the same. They are milquetoast.
Yeah, for sure. So I wasn't like really inspired. I wasn't like going, holy cow, this guy just does it for me. And quite honestly, the minutiae of municipal governing, just come on. And, you know, we're talking about the water deal and building sidewalks and replacing. I mean, come on. And so I remember not really being excited, but it was 99. It was the only race going, right? And so one night, I remember this very clearly, my wife and I were newly married, been married about a year, and we were at home and we were watching the first debates. And it was a three-way debate. And it was, as you mentioned, it was Bart, it was Sue Ann, and it was Andy Horning, the Libertarian nominee, who I never heard of. I didn't even know what the hell a Libertarian was. Like, I didn't know, I wasn't even that clued into, you know, governing, that I knew, you know, that there even were three parties in Indiana. I had no idea. And so what I remember was watching the debates and Bart and Sue Ann bickering and talking over each other and not really saying anything, and Andy, and you know this, having tons of very insightful responses. And mm-hmm. he was saying things that really resonated with me, that really, like, and again, now I'm a couple of years off of, you know, John Locke, and I progressed into the other founding fathers, and to some extent, and Andy really hit the button with me, right? I don't know how else to
explain. Yeah.
And I remember every time looking at my wife going, oh my God, I love what he just said. Oh my God, I love what he just said. And so I sent him an email that night. Kids, by the way, you couldn't do it from your phone. You had to go walk in and boot up your computer and listen for the and then wait your 10 minutes and then get in and you have mail. And then I sent him an email. I think you couldn't Google because Google didn't even exist. I found
actually it did, but in beta form.
Okay, well, I knew you would know that.
I was in college at the time, and my roommate was a computer science major, and it was 1998, and I remember him saying, oh man, you got to check out this website, it's called Google. I was like, what the heck is that? We already have Yahoo and Alta Vista.
Well, Yahoo was where all the cool kids were. And so
that's right.
I think I found andyforandy.org, which you may remember that URL because he kept it for years.
Oh, I do.
He may still have it for all I know. He actually probably does, knowing Andy, who is getting way more shout outs tonight than I ever thought he was going to. And reading his website, which was pretty much all text-based, your typical libertarian campaign website, which is just all text-based, and, you know.
That's right.
45,000 characters on, you know, why the founding fathers were right and everything else. And I sent him an email, and he responded that night.
Really?
Blew me away. Yeah, blew me away. And I had coffee with him the very next morning. And now, I don't know if you knew this or not. I was a journalism guy when I was younger. I was an editor of a high school paper, one of the editors of the yearbook. I think I was sports editor of the yearbook or something. Had journalism scholarships to IU. And that was sort of my entry into Andy's campaign, was I could write. And I also had a little bit of exposure to the media, and sort of knew how they worked. And so that was way more sophistication than anybody in the Libertarian Party had. I mean, the fact that I had a byline in the Indiana Daily Student trumped the entire Libertarian Party of Indiana as far as resume. That right there put me on a pedestal. Plus, I had way more campaign experience than any of them had. I mean, in 1999 and probably 2020, a Libertarian campaign consisted of going down to the post office on tax day and holding up signs saying taxation is theft. That was their entire campaign strategy. And I blew their mind by telling them, you could knock on doors, you know, and you could actually put out yard signs, and you could actually create print. And they just were like, what is this sorcery you speak of, young sir? Like, they were blown away entirely. No idea what I was talking about. So automatically I was like the most sophisticated guy in Andy's campaign. Like, I'm not even joking. And we had a lot of fun, and I think Andy got 2 or 3%. But you know, he was a great guy to work with at that time. You know, it opened a lot of doors. And so then he immediately then announced his campaign for governor in 2000. And I was his press secretary. I was either press secretary or comms. I think it was press. And that wasn't like a full-time job. That was like, here's gas money to drive Andy to Elkhart to do a speech kind of a job.
Yeah, yeah.
But that's when I got to know a lot of the members of the Indiana media. Kevin Rader and I became close. A couple other people, I mean, Kevin and I still actually are. A couple other people who I got to know, Norm Koch, got to know Norm pretty well. And because I was very proactive, I would, you know, pick up the phone and call them, and, you know, blew their mind that somebody from the Libertarian Party was actually calling them on the phone, because I don't think anybody in the LP knew that phones existed. I think they just thought, you know, it was a government conspiracy and the government had tapped your phone and they were going to, you know, tax you or some nonsense. And so that was a full, almost a full calendar year. Now, keep in mind, I had a day job. I can't remember what I was doing at that time. I think I was managing a retail store or something, but I had enough flexibility where I could adjust my schedule to go and do things, right?
Yeah.
And then I also helped, I don't know if he's our mutual friend or not, but Joe Houtman, who was running against your old boss. I think that was the first time he ran against him, as I recall. And so I got sucked into helping him out and writing for him. And because Joe is a very intelligent, erudite guy, but a terrible writer. He's not listening to this, so I don't mind saying that. So I wrote a lot of stuff for him. And then that was kind of, I guess, having that much exposure to the LP sort of was like, oh my God, this is amateur hour. Like I've always kind of prided myself, and you know this, in professionalism and knowing your shit and being organized, sorry, Jack, and knowing what you're supposed to be doing and being focused and having a plan. And all those words are like Chinese to a libertarian. Like, they have no idea what you're talking about. A plan? What's a plan? A plan is a government conspiracy. You may have to pay a tax on it. Like, I mean, it just, it blows their mind when you talk about being organized and having a strategy and having a message and being consistent with your message. Keep in mind, the 92 Clinton-Gore campaign is infamous for, it's the economy, stupid. You know, this
hell
whole,
yeah.
The whole idea of everything, and I'm not saying they were the first ones to do it because they weren't, but for me, it was my first exposure with messaging and how powerful it was that you could stay on point. And every thing that you do, every piece of communication that you do can be filtered through that one message. And keep in mind, I didn't go to college for this. So I learned hands-on, and it boggled my mind. So I tried to teach these LP guys this, you know, while they're all high and, you know, collecting a government check because they're not actually working, ironically. And I just got really fed up with it. And so 2002 was sort of my fence straddling, because when I decided I wasn't going to be a Democrat anymore, I couldn't fathom going directly to becoming a Republican. Like, that for me was too, I couldn't even fathom that concept. Yeah. So 2002, I actually had been offered the executive director position of the Libertarian National Party, because pretty much the entire leadership of the Libertarian National Party came from Indiana. Steve mm-hmm. Dossbach and a couple of those guys, Joe Houtman, had been national chair. And so they offered me the position of executive director full time in DC, which I thought about for like 5 seconds, and they told me it paid like $40,000 a year in 2000 DC. And I'm like, I make more than that now, and I make a lot more than that now, and $40,000 in DC is food stamp money, so that's not happening.
Practically, yeah.
And so at that time, and I may have dates off a little bit, so somebody's Googling all this and I get busted, don't tweet me because I don't care. Because the story is more important than the dates. So what I remember is either 2002, I, against my knowledge and will, got put on the ballot against Jim Adderholt, which was Indiana House 82, I believe.
86. But you were put on the ballot?
I think we can Google this. I think it was Jim's first re-election. That's what I remember.
It was
first time I know he had won a special or had been appointed or something, and it was his first time defending his seat.
Yeah.
And so this is a funny story, and you'll preach this because you know Jim and you admire him as much as I do. He's now a Floridian, by the way. I don't know if you knew that.
I did.
Actually just got elected to Fort Myers town council or something, as a matter of fact. Go figure.
Jim can't give it up.
That guy. So I got put on the ballot, which is the Libertarian Party way of doing things. You know, hey, by the way, you're now the candidate in House 86. Okay, what does that mean? You know, and because it's me, I had to take it seriously. So I started going to events because I'm the candidate. And because, as you know, Libertarian Party has automatic ballot access in Indiana, you are treated as an equal candidate with the other two guys. It's not petition, not any of that nonsense. You know, if there's an event, there's three microphones on stage. There's not two. And so I started going to things and speaking, and no idea what the hell I was talking about. No idea. Probably still don't. I mean, basically, take my Twitter feed and subtract about 90 IQ points. That's pretty much where I was at that point, which I know is just blew your mind.
Yeah.
Because that's, yeah, that's special needs level. So anyway.
Oh, boy.
So I went to, this is a true story. I went to the Hobnob. I don't know if they even still do this. The chamber did the Hobnob at Union Station.
Yeah.
And I went, and I had flyers. I made up flyers and printed up on my home computer. And it talked about essentially how I was running against a corporate shill and a sellout and a guy who was screwing you over, you know, career politician, Jim Matterhold. I had, like, all his sins listed on this flyer. And I went to Union Station, to the big banquet hall Union Station, and I'm passing them out. And this nerdy dude in glasses in a suit, about 5'10", a buck 50, walks up to me and takes one, takes a flyer, and reads it, and smiles, and says, "Hey, Jacob, how are you? I'm Jim Adderholt. And I've been looking forward to meeting you." And I was like, "Oh, hey, Jim, how are you? Nice to meet you, blah, blah, blah." As you know, now our listeners may not know, Jim Adderholt may arguably be the nicest human being on planet Earth.
He is literally the Mr. Rogers. He's the Mr. Rogers of Indiana politics.
He is the kindest, nicest,
so kind,
most gentle, just the nicest man ever. And
absolutely,
he and I
cannot
stood
disagree.
There for 20 minutes and had the best conversation ever. And he was talking about how great it was that I was running, about what a good experience it would be for me. I mean, just totally, like, now look, he mind fucked me, right? Like, that's the other part of Jim is, yeah, he's the nicest guy in the world, but he's not stupid. And
yeah. It
totally threw me off, because then I'm the first guy to go. You know, I got to go up and do my 5-minute speech, and now I love the guy. Like, I want to be his nephew now. And I didn't know what the hell to say. So pretty much like, "Hey, I'm Jacob Perry, I'm a Libertarian candidate for House 86. Thanks. Peace out." Because I didn't know what to say. Because it is Wiley Jim Adderhole stole my thunder. But
he knew exactly what he was doing.
Absolutely knew what he was doing. Sharpest dude ever. But what happened was that started a friendship, which I'm proud to say continues to this day. And we, Jim and I, started a book club. I don't even know if you know this. Where
no.
I, at that time, I was working in a retail store up at Keystone Crossing, which of course is where you know who had an office. Mm-hmm. And I would go on my lunch break, I would walk over to the office and meet with Jim, and we would exchange books. And they weren't, you know, like Sean Hannity, or they weren't like the typical right-wing rant books you have today. They were deep, thoughtful, you know, commentary on the Federalist Papers and things, you know, that I never would have read in a million years. And I gave him books, you know, libertarian books, and you know, we just had the best conversation. I would spend my lunch hours like once a week in the office with Jim, which is how I met Rick. That's how I met Mike. So I got to know those guys because I was in the office once a week hanging out with all of them. And I got to the point where, because Jim, we would go into you know, whose office, the big office with the big leather couch. And all four of us would go in there and spend the lunch hour talking about the book. And for me, they were probably some of the first Republicans I'd ever met. And it was an introduction to me of, hey, maybe all Republicans don't hate people. Like, you know, maybe there's actually some nice Republicans and they actually are smart and they actually have thought through, you know, and yeah. Rick and I probably connected the most because Rick and I come from very similar backgrounds, which is why we're still close to this day. Whereas Mike and Jim were probably more dyed in the wool, you know, lifelong Republicans who grew up in Republican clubs and blah, 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 blah. So I think, and you can correct me, Mike ran for Secretary of State, I believe, in 2002.
Oh, he did, yes.
Okay. So he asked me to help him on his campaign. And so that was the first Republican campaign I ever worked on, was Mike's pre-convention, of course, Secretary of State race, where I know he had a campaign manager, but that's all he had. He didn't have anybody else. It was just Mike and whoever's campaign manager, and of course, Beth and me. And I would, what I did was I would go around to events where, and I can't remember who all was running. Was that Rokita? Was he running in that race? I kind of think he was.
Yes, that was Rokita. There was a third person in that race, and I'm blanking on the name right now.
It was the IU basketball guy.
Oh, yeah, that's right. And I forget who that is, too. But you're right.
I would go to events in other parts of the state where those guys were speaking, and I would take notes. And then I would go back to Mike and I would say, Kent something, Kent whatever, played on the 76 team or something. And I would go back to Mike. We'd have meetings at Mike's house in Carmel. He and Beth and I would sit at the kitchen table and I would go over, hey, this is what Todd said. This is what Kent whatever said. You know, here's some things that really resonate. I talked to people in the crowd. Here's what they said. And probably 2002, Mike was the guy who kind of came to me and said, you're a Republican. But this is stupid. Why are you doing this? You're a Republican. Mm-hmm. You know, why don't you just get off the pot? And at that year, 2002, both Joe Houtman and Andy ran house races. Joe was on the ballot again against you know who, and mm-hmm. Andy ran against Julia, I believe, as an independent. I don't believe he actually ran as a libertarian. You can look this up. Vaguely recall he ran as an independent. I don't know why. It just that's what stands out in my memory. And so I was kind of working, and I say working in giant air quotes because I don't think I got a dime from either one of them, for both of them, writing speeches. And Joe in 2002, the only thing I remember from that race was we didn't, and this was still legal then, we didn't advertise Joe's name on websites. On yard signs. The yard sign said blessgov.com. It was sort of the original guerrilla bandit campaign, right? Mm-hmm. And it was Joe's idea. And that was our website, of course. And so we never had any Joe Houtman for Congress yard signs. They all were lessgov.com. And we blanketed the district with lessgov.com websites, which of course failed spectacularly, but it was a great lesson to me in guerrilla campaigning and messaging so at that time I had a radio production business, I think you know this, with the late great Joe Padgett, RIP, and had been given a commitment to put Andy Horning on the air on the radio by XNT. XNT had just come into the market and we had an agreement with them. And the LP, the guys in the LP, and I'm not going to name any names because it doesn't matter at this point, stiffed me on funding the show.
Seriously?
When I went into the XNT, and there's a reason why I'm telling the story, I'm not just trying to get in the weeds. I went into XNT, made a commitment. It was a partial barter. So, like, I could bring advertisers, and some of those guys owned businesses. One of them owned an insurance agency and a couple different things. And then I had to buy some of the ads, and then I had to bring ad with me. It was one of those kind of deals. And so we actually got on the air and had some programming, and I'm not going to go down that whole road because that'll be it for episode 7. But when they stiffed me on the deal, that sort of was like the last straw for me. It was kind of like, these guys really are clowns. Like, I guess I felt like I was 27, felt like I was serious at this point. I was ready to be serious about politics and actually maybe even do it for a career. And I didn't want to be associated with these clowns who couldn't even come up with a few hundred bucks a week, is essentially what it boiled down to. Mike recruited me into the GOP. I changed my registration. I think I was a delegate to the state convention. I actually tried to vote for Mike. That's a whole other story. and watched the whole floor show with Rikita and all that kind of nonsense. And then I decided that the next step had to be Andy running for Congress as a Republican. Because I had convinced myself that he was as serious as I was. Excuse me. Sorry. And so he was ready kind of for the next step. And so I had been good friends with some people whose names I'm not going to mention, but people who you know, who were executive director of the party at the time. And brought Andy in. I can't remember who exactly was state party chair, but I know who ED was. But we had a series of meetings. And then
It was a furniture owner.
Correct. Kittle. It was Jim Kittle. That's correct. And Eric was involved. I had met Eric. And he had been working for John Hosteller, I believe. Don't quote me on this. And I know I'm really getting in the weeds, but there's a point to all this. And so...
Hey, you were talking about current Governor Holcomb. Eric,
correct.
Indiana Gov. Yeah, correct. Eric Holcomb.
Because, you know, we're boys, so I can say Eric. But so...
just trying to fill the gaps for the people who are listening.
So Eric came to me and said, hey, Mitch was running for governor? Or was either... Was Mitch running or Mitch was governor?
No, 2004, that was his first year running. Joe Kernan was governor at the time. And, and people should know that John Hosteller was, and this is kind of bastardizing the term a bit, but he was Indiana's answer to Ron Paul, or the equivalent.
John Ho was kind of the godfather of young Indiana conservatives.
He was. And John was definitely like a strict constitutionalist, but he wasn't as openly libertarian as Ron Paul was. John played the game, and he won. He was known as the Bloody Eighth until he won all the time.
Correct.
Up until his loss against Brad Ellsworth.
One of the best grassroots campaigners in Indiana, period, flat out.
Oh, yeah. And so then... Staffer Eric Holcomb.
Correct. A lot of our mutual friends and guys who we know and then love, whatever, all came kind of from that school. And so Eric actually took me out for lunch one day and said that Mitch was running. My wife at the time was working at Eli Lilly, so I knew who Mitch was, and I knew, you know, his background. I didn't know he had worked for Luger and whatever, but I knew who Mitch was.
Yeah.
And so got involved in that race. Again, sort of a regional, you know, essentially a Marion County guy. And then wasn't really sure. This would have been fall 03 when things started kind of rolling. And then I decided that I wasn't really sure where this politics thing was going. And I wasn't convinced I was going to make a living at it. And the one thing that I always wanted to do in my life was to be an airline pilot. And so I essentially dropped out of politics and dropped off of Mitch's campaign, which is probably the dumbest thing I've ever done in my entire life, and went to flight school. And I was actually in flight school full time, taking flight lessons and going through the whole thing. And Andy had already filed his paper as a Republican, had already made the switch and gone through all that nonsense. And then spring of 04, I come home one day. And my wife, much to my utter shock and surprise, tells me that she's pregnant. We had sort of given up trying, and we'd been married 7 years at that point, I believe, and had decided we were moving on to our next step in our life. My wife was going to be a flight attendant. She worked for Southwest Airlines at that time. She had moved on from Eli Lilly. And when she was going to be a flight attendant, I was going to be a pilot. We were going to move to Texas or somewhere like that. And as soon as I finished flight school, and I knew that night that I didn't want to be a pilot anymore, because I knew that being a father was the most important thing in my life, as you know, because it is for you. And I needed a job. So I called Andy. I called Andy and I said, are you still looking for a campaign manager? And he said, hopefully I'm not after tonight. And he offered me a position as his campaign manager. And that was my first full-time paid position in politics. I mean, I had gotten paid before, but that was my first full-time, had an agreement, and here's your job, and yada, yada, yada.
Yeah. So that's quite the circumstances of events there, you know. That's obviously that 2004 campaign had a big impact on how we know each other.
Correct.
And that was 2004.
About you?
No, I already did a podcast about me, man. I already did that. It was the shortest podcast this one has ever had so far.
Yes.
But that was definitely kind of an up and down year for you and your involvement in that campaign. But let's fast forward a bit, you know, to you've moved back to Florida from Indiana.
Correct.
You've worked on the campaign. You were involved locally. You had your own website. You were a part of my website off and on, as a contributor. But ultimately, you ended up in Florida, and a lot of that has to politically, as far as the story goes, is that as I recall it, you know, things did not. And we're kind of truncating things a bit here. Things did not work out well. When you talk about one of the biggest moves you regret is not working on is leaving Mitch's campaign.
Right.
It's kind of interesting to see where, like, in an alternate timeline, how things would have worked out if you had stayed there.
Sure.
But things change. So you end up back in Florida, and you've kind of established yourself down there. You've worked on a number of campaigns. You've gotten a member of Congress elected, a current member of Congress.
Finally. I figure if you keep trying, you know, over and over and over, at some point it's got to work, right?
Hey, everyone. These conversations keep going on, and I'm loving it. There is so much to everyone's stories, so much that makes them who they are, that it makes you realize we can't all be classified into a two-party system. We're more than the sum of our political leanings. Mind you, there's still a lot to cover with Jacob Perry, so please tune in again next week for part two of our conversation. As always, be sure to follow The Political Nomad on the socials, facebook.com/thenomadpod and @thenomadpod on Twitter. Also, sign up for our weekly newsletter, The Nomad News. It's the only place you can get access to the political road trip playlists for every show. Sign up today at joshgillespie.com. And subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts or on any of your favorite podcast platforms. See you next time.